In 1859, John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry shocked and divided the Union. But who was this firebrand? Hero or villain? Martyr or terrorist? Prophet or madman? Hi, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today we'll explore this complex character as we go between the lines of Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War, by award-winning author Tony Horowitz. Tony is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of several bestsellers, such as Confederates in the Attic, A Voyage Long and Strange, and Baghdad Without a Map. He's worked for the Wall Street Journal and the New Yorker. He's been a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard and a visiting scholar at Brown University. He lives in Martha's Vineyard with his author wife, Geraldine Brooks. Welcome, Tony. Thanks for allowing us to go between the lines with you today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so tell us about this John Brown. Who was he? What kind of person was he?
I think he was quite different from the way many Americans imagine. I think people see this sort of wild-haired, wild-eyed fanatic, possibly insane, self-appointed prophet. But when you delve into his life, the first surprise for me was that for the first 55 years, he was actually a fairly conventional American on the make. Uh-huh. He was a businessman who wore starched shirts and dark suits. He was a quite traditional person in many ways, a family man. He fathered 20 children.
Whoa. So
he's not a sort of crazed lone gunman in the model of others who have committed acts of violence.
But yet he was a fundamentalist, a Calvinist, and it seems that he felt he was chosen by God to destroy slavery. Talk about this, mm-hmm. this strong predestination, if you will.
Right. From his father, he was given really this very staunch Calvinism, really the Puritan faith. And one aspect of it is a really almost a fixation on sin, personal and collective. And in their view, the great sin of the nation at that time was slavery. And John Brown felt it was his God-given destiny to do the job of destroying slavery. He's almost an Ahab figure, except with slavery as the white whale. Mm-hmm. He really pledges his life to this mission.
Was he the arrogant, domineering, and as some say, depressed person?
I mean, he was a difficult man. He was a very obsessive figure, very determined. Yeah, he was hard on his children. He was hard on his own men, his followers. But he had this determination. And I don't think he was insane. He knew what he was doing by attacking Harper's Ferry. And in the end, he ultimately achieved his mission.
Well, before Harper's Ferry, he was even well known as a leading abolitionist. How did he get to that point?
Mm-hmm. He, for decades, sort of plotted this war on slavery. But he doesn't really begin the fight until the unlikely age of 55. He goes to Kansas with his sons. And Kansas at that time is the front line in the war over slavery's extension. And he essentially takes on pro-slave forces in Kansas quite viciously. And this makes him quite famous and infamous in the nation as really the leading anti-slavery warrior.
Mm. Well, now he brought his family along with him, though, in this mission, so to speak. Talk about his family. Were they there willingly? Did they feel obligated? How did that work out?
Yeah, his family went through a lot of hardship. Even before he begins this crusade, he goes bankrupt. 9 of his 20 children die before the age of 10. Mm. His first wife dies in childbirth. Repeated family tragedies and poverty. But they share his ferocious abolitionism. So I don't think they're dragged along unwillingly. But they do suffer a great deal. 3 of his sons die fighting with him.
Mm. Who were some of his early recruits outside of the family?
Mm-hmm. This, to me, was one of the most interesting parts of the story. These wonderful accomplices of his, this extraordinary cast of characters, farmers, factory workers, Jewish shopkeepers, free blacks, fugitive slaves, a very diverse group. They're not blind cult followers. They're Americans from all over who share his conviction. And they're also young men, so they misbehave. They work the girls hard. You know, we're risking our lives to free 4 million slaves. And they're, you know, they're working that line hard with the girls. So yeah, they're a very colorful group of men.
He tried to recruit though several VIP African Americans, if you will, Harriet Tubman, who is the other one?
Frederick Douglass,
right.
Right. Yeah, he goes through a very long courtship, particularly with Frederick Douglass, who admires what Brown wants to do, but like many others, doubts his chances of success. And Douglass, in the end, does not go with Brown. And I think he and many other blacks recognize that this mission was probably doomed. And for a black person to go with this band, they were certainly doomed. And sadly, that was the case for four of the five men who went with Brown.
Mm-hmm. So why didn't Harriet Tubman join with him?
Harriet Tubman meets with Brown and appears to give him some support and advice, but in the end, she also does not join him. It's a little unclear why. She's sick the summer before the raid, but I suspect that, like Frederick Douglass, she had her doubts about the viability of this mission.
Well, in the very beginning, he had this little core group called the Secret Six. Yeah. Let's talk about them. I mean, that was an amazing collection of individuals in terms of their talents and their interests.
Right. The Secret Six were Brown's core financial supporters. And even though they have this covert name, they were actually very public, prominent men. Four of them are Harvard graduates. Two of them are leading magnates in the North. They're sort of armchair radicals who funnel him money and guns, don't want to get involved directly, but they're sort of cheering from behind the lines. And two of them are ministers. They're reformers. They're not what you imagine as the backers of this sort of abolitionist secret cell.
One in particular, was it Theodore Parker? I'm not sure. Harvard grad, but also a transcendentalist.
Yeah. Parker was one of the most prominent transcendentalist ministers of the day and a very eloquent orator who, among other things, was famous for stating that the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. This line is often attributed to others, but it was actually Theodore Parker, one of Brown's supporters.
Another interesting one was Samuel Howe, well, maybe even more so his wife.
Yeah, Samuel Gridley Howe's wife is Julia Ward Howe, who, of course, writes the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which becomes the anthem of the Union cause. And it's based on a song called John Brown's Body. And she, you know, John Brown's body is, you know, all that.
Based on John Brown himself?
She took
himself?
The tune. Yeah, well, she took the tune and gave it new words.
Wow.
So while John Brown is not mentioned in the song, if you listen to it, it's about his spirit marching on. So there's an interesting connection there through the Secret Six to this famous song.
Now, he had the rich, the poor, the black, the white, you mentioned, such a diverse group. But one of those interesting characters in particular to me was John Cook.
Oh, yeah.
The blonde, what should we call him?
Charmer.
Romeo. Oh, Charmer. Let's get Charmer. All right.
Yeah, John Cook is one of my favorite among the raiders. He's a well-born Connecticut Yankee who trains for the law, but he loves romance novels, and he goes off to Kansas and becomes a crack shot and abolitionist fighter. And he's also, yes, this blonde, blue-eyed, curly-haired charmer. One of the other men calls him suavity itself. And he goes ahead to Harper's Ferry a year before Brown and the other men to act as a spy. And he's so good at this that he charms his way into plantations and homes of prominent Virginians, even marries a local girl, without anyone realizing that he's plotting an attack on this town. He's a very a daring, crafty, colorful figure.
One of the other fascinating things from your book is how many literary supporters John Brown had. Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Herman Melville, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Why were these people supporting John Brown and praising him even?
Right. Initially, after the raid, Brown was condemned in most of the North for taking violence into his own hands, and they felt this was giving abolitionism a bad name. Most abolitionists were staunch pacifists. But because of his eloquence and courage in prison and court and in facing death, he became this hero martyr to many Northerners. And the writers you mentioned, Thoreau, Emerson, Melville, Alcott, others, wrote poetry about him, wrote long essays about him. They were enamored of this man who was willing to take on the great moral issue of the day. And he seemed to exemplify that civil disobedience, although it was rather uncivil disobedience, that Thoreau wrote about, of the individual acting on his own conscience against a government he felt was unjust.
Mm. Henry David Thoreau also said about him, quote, "He could not have been tried by a jury of his peers because his peers did not exist."
Yeah, it has to be said that they were glossing over perhaps some of the more troubling aspects of Brown's character, while many white Southerners turned him into a complete demon. Northerners did the opposite, and they made him this sort of unblemished saint. And Brown is neither. He's a very complicated, troubling figure, in some ways quite admirable and inspiring, yet also disturbing in his violence.
Speaking of violence, the Pottawatomie, is that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. The Pottawatomie Massacre. Mm-hmm. Was he really involved in that? He is a little
unclear.
Ambiguous about it. Yeah.
Yeah, this is sort of Brown's coming out as a violent abolitionist. In Kansas, after a number of outrages by the pro-slavery forces, he leads a party in a night raid on a small pro-slavery settlement by Pottawatomie Creek, drags five men from their beds and hacks them to death with broadswords. And this is a shocking action, and he intends it to have a shocking effect, basically saying, you've been pushing us around, we will push back. And it terrified Southern settlers in Kansas.
So trying to strike fear into their hearts, like, if I come after you,
this is what's going to happen.
Right, right.
And it also aroused the sort of latent fear that white Southerners had from the Nat Turner Rebellion, that at any moment slaves might rise up and slaughter them in their beds.
Right.
So I think he was consciously modeling it on that.
Well, let's talk about the mission. Attacking Harper's Ferry. I've got to confess, I watch the military channel. And so I'm intrigued by strategy and so forth. I just could not understand John Brown's strategy on this move. So talk about what the mission was, his objective, and how he planned to go about it.
Yeah, Brown was a rather idiosyncratic military thinker. He had some strange notions, one of which is that a ravine is easier to defend than high ground. And it's a little hard to tell exactly what he intended here because he gave different versions to different people. But the best guess is that he wanted to take this guerrilla force, seize the armory at Harper's Ferry and its 100,000 guns, free and arm slaves from surrounding plantations, and then retreat to the mountains and continue south along the Allegheny, the Appalachian Ridge, and with these hit-and-run attacks that he thought would ultimately destabilize slavery.
Mm.
I don't think it was at all a realistic plan militarily, and it didn't work. He didn't make the preparations necessary to even give it a chance.
Say make the preparations necessary, for instance?
Well, if he was going to retreat from Harper's Ferry back to the mountains with freed slaves and others he thought might join him, where was he going to go? He had no position in the mountains. Winter was coming on. It was late October. How was he going to feed these people? How is he going to transport all these 100,000 guns from Harper's Ferry? He's got one wagon. So I think he also did it as much for shock value as logistics. He wanted to really shock and cause terror by seizing this symbol of American power.
The armory.
And in the biggest slave state in the country, announcing he's there to free slaves and force the nation to face this issue.
A couple of things, more than one thing, went wrong, though. The bridge, talk about that, the Potomac Bridge.
Yeah, he only has 18 men, and Harper's Ferry is in a river gorge, and it's surrounded by rivers and mountains, and really the two river bridges control access into town. There are no silencers in 1859, so when one of his men gets nervous and fires in the night, Virginians sort of wake up to what's going on. And ultimately, they retake the bridge, both bridges, so that Brown, who didn't have much of an exit strategy to begin with, ends up really trapped in Harper's Ferry.
Well, if you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson. Well over 150 years ago, one of the most well-known terrorists in America was hanged. But before he was hanged, he prophesied that this land would be free of the sin of slavery only through bloodshed. That man was John Brown. And today I'm going between the lines of Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War, by best-selling author Tony Horowitz. The irony of it, too, is that he never took any of the guns out of there. What was that about? I thought his plan was supposed to go in, take the guns out to his guerrillas who would be meeting him outside. But that didn't happen. How did he end up in the engine room, sort of?
Right. He takes the armory, which is this huge facility, and he never touches the guns. In fact, he's bringing forward his own guns. It is rather bizarre. I think possibly he thought slaves and others, he thought non-slave holding whites, for instance, this is a factory town, would rush to join him as well. So perhaps he imagined handing out guns right there in Harper's Ferry. It's not clear. Mm-hmm. But what happens in the end, it becomes like a bank heist gone bad, with the robbers and their hostages, because they've taken hostages, stuck inside the bank, surrounded, and they have to shoot their way out or negotiate their way out. So it becomes a very tense, dramatic scene, but it's really doomed almost from the start.
Did this collection of guerrillas and freedmen and white men who wanted to end slavery, did they show up?
Well, he had 21 men, of whom 18 go forward with him into Harper's Ferry. The others stay back to guard supplies. They free about a dozen slaves. But, you know, they never really have a chance. This isn't a big enough force to really do much beyond this initial surprise attack.
So he hadn't coordinated before that the whites and the slaves to be aware that he was even going to do this so that they could come out and help him, huh?
Exactly. This is another mystery of what his plan was. He told John Cook, his spy in town, to not tell anybody what they were up to. So slaves really had no way of knowing what was going on, or others. The townspeople were confused. They didn't think at first they were abolitionists. They thought they were just robbers. They were going after the safe at the armory. So I think he did not think clearly here, and I think also he was just prepared to die in Harper's Ferry and realized that might have equal value.
Yeah. Prepared to die. As a matter of fact, the 18 men all wrote farewell notes to their families.
Most of them before they went. Essentially said goodbye before they went, because they recognized they were on, I don't think they viewed it as a suicide mission, but certainly as a very hazardous one.
But Brown was very ambitious, or at least he appeared to be very confident. He even drafted a new constitution for this new country, I guess.
This is another, you know, interesting corner of the story. Brown does. He thinks very big. He's got a whole political program, and he's thinking he's going to found a revolutionary government in the mountains, and he writes his own Declaration of Independence and his own constitution. And it looks like the U.S. Constitution has articles and a preamble, but it gives full equal rights to not only African Americans, but also women. It's a very forward-looking document. And he then has a constitutional convention where blacks in Canada ratify it, and they nominate a black man for president.
Whoa.
1859. Yep. Whoa. So he was definitely ahead of his times. But it was a rather striking document, and a little peculiar in some ways.
So he was overcome at Harper's Ferry. As a matter of fact, you say it took only 3 minutes for the Marines to overrun the engine room. Is that right?
Well, the final assault, the fighting goes on for a couple of days, but the very final assault, they bang down the doors of the engine house and run in with bayonets. And these troops are led by Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart. And later on, Stonewall Jackson and John Wilkes Booth show up. This is like a dress rehearsal for the Confederacy.
Amazing. All right, talk about his trial in terms of what happened after he was captured.
Right. He's quickly,
and he was injured, seriously, right?
He's wounded at Harper's Ferry, and a week later, he and his surviving men are put on trial. And Virginia, it's open to the press. This is not a military closed tribunal. It's filled with press. And Brown, who has essentially failed as a warrior, ironically triumphs for the word. Here's a man who had contempt for abolitionists who just talked. He says that's milk and water abolitionism. We need to, take up arms. Well, he does that and fails, but he triumphs for the word. He's so eloquent, and he cuts through decades of cant about slavery and says, you know, God and justice on this side, slavery on this side, which side are you on? And really forces people to take a hard look at this, and it really divides the nation. It's already a troubled nation, but it definitely deepens the divide.
Well, he was sentenced to hang, and from what you say in the book, in Midnight Rising, people came from all over for the hanging.
Yeah, it was a little bit ghoulish. There were tour groups that wanted to come see him hang. He had become, by this point, a national celebrity, really. This was covered daily in the press. This was one of the first breaking news stories in the nation because of the recent introduction of the telegraph and the growth of newspapers and wire services. So stories are going off all around the country on an almost hourly basis. So people are following this from around the nation. And so, yes, they want to come. Some want to come watch him hang.
How long between the time that he was captured and the sentencing?
He's sentenced just 2 weeks after his capture, and then he hangs a month after.
Oh, so there was time for people
after his sentencing.
And
he has a month also where he's writing letters from prison. And if the Virginians had been smart, they would have executed him right away, or better yet, not executed him, and he wouldn't have become perhaps the martyr that he did.
Mm. Tony, tell us about this prophecy and how true was it?
Yeah, Brown, before he goes to the gallows, he's been told he will not be allowed to give a speech from the scaffold. They're scared he'll cause a stir. So on his way out of the jail, he hands a note to a guard, and it reads, "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood." And, 18 months later, the Civil War begins. And I think this is what Brown wanted to bring about. I don't think he wanted 620,000 people to die, as did in the war. Mm-hmm. But he felt conflict was necessary to end slavery. So while he didn't live to see it, I think he would have been gratified by the result.
Hmm. Well, we mentioned that the Harpers Ferry military attempt was a failure on his part, but I guess he succeeded in really doing what he wanted to do, which was to evoke terror into the hearts. Well, you tell me,
right.
What was it that he was trying to do?
He certainly caused terror, panic, paranoia in the South. And that really helped lead to secession. You have cries for secession very quickly after this. It also helps elect Abraham Lincoln, who cleverly uses Brown as a foil. This happens in the middle of a presidential campaign. And Lincoln uses Brown to position himself as the moderate in the Republican field. He condemns Brown, and he says, "I'm the safe moderate here." And the front runner, he's, a little bit of a little to the edge here. He seems a calming figure. And also, the raid helps break up the Democratic Party, which helps Lincoln then win in the general election. Hmm. So I think you can argue that without John Brown's raid, Lincoln might not have been elected. And then who knows?
Wow.
Yeah.
So reaction in the North was generally one of praise and support?
Yeah, for Brown, anti-slavery Northerners. Not all Northerners were anti-slavery, but it was, yes, adulation and respect, and also anger at the South's reaction. They thought, boy, these people in the South have gone crazy because Southerners are going all over on a witch hunt looking for abolitionists after they become convinced that there are 1,000 plots, even here in Georgia, all over the South. And I think Northerners look at this reaction by the South and the words that are coming out, Jefferson Davis saying, "We will dissever the ties that bind us, even if it leads us into a sea of blood." And I think it's really the two regions begin for the first time really to see each other as very separate peoples and in some ways enemies.
Talk a moment about the blacks in the South, because there were some people that said that the blacks really didn't want to get involved with it. Yet after he was hanged, they had such things as Martyrs Day, which was a service in his honor. Tell me about the blacks in the South.
Right. Well, first of all, Brown was very distinct from most other abolitionists who had a really a condescending attitude towards blacks.
Most of the other abolitionists.
Yeah, most other abolitionists thought blacks were too docile and inferior to fight for their own freedom. And Brown said nonsense. He felt it was a necessity and a moral imperative for blacks and whites to fight together to end this institution. He stayed at black homes. Blacks stayed with him. This was very unusual for this era. So he's remarkable in that way. And he was immediately really an icon for black Americans and has remained so, I think, for many people over the decades. He became a symbol in the early civil rights movement. There were pilgrimages to Harper's Ferry. His name has often been invoked in the continuing struggle for equal rights.
Do you believe that there are some lessons that we can learn from Brown's raid about battling inequality today?
I think one lesson is that it's never easy. It's never popular. Not just Brown, other abolitionists we forget today, they were a tiny minority in their day and very disliked. They were seen as cranks and scolds. I don't know what would be comparable today. Maybe people who go on about climate change all the time, and you kind of, you know they're right, but I want to go to get on with my life. Some people who are constantly forcing you to face your own shortcomings. And so they were not a popular group. And I think people who begin movements of social change or change of any kind rarely are. And also, I think it shows that in troubled times, change can bubble up from the extremes. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say today is anything like 1859, thank gosh. Right. But, you know, it's interesting what's happening with Tea Party on one hand and Occupy Wall Street on the other. These things bubble up. People look for blunt, emotionally satisfying solutions in difficult times. And that's somewhat of what Brown offered.
Do you see any parallels between John Brown's raid and 9/11?
Yeah, there are some inevitable echoes in the number of men, 19, a long-bearded fundamentalist leading a something of a suicide strike on a symbol of American power that shocks the nation and leads it towards war. But I think it's a mistake to see him as a terrorist in the way we've come to think of it, as Islamic extremists or domestic bombers who kill thousands of innocents. He didn't kill indiscriminately. He had a specific target, the institution of slavery, and he had a program. So I think he wanted to cause terror, but I don't think he should be sort of lumped with what we've come to think of as terrorists today.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've certainly opened my eyes on a few things. Thank you very much, Tony Horowitz. Tony's latest book is Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. This has been fascinating.
My pleasure.
Between the Lines is brought to you in part by Jackmont Hospitality and a generous anonymous supporter. We thank you. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, go to our website at wabe.org/BTL and listen to an archived program. Or check out our suggested reading list for both children and adults. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to our website and click on Podcast. Be sure to join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor and technical producer, Mike Johns. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.